Hello, happy new year, and welcome back to the Ear Fuel podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can find me on Twitter at @GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru. The podcast is always available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Ear Fuel and at GetEarFuel.com. So I am back from my three-week journey across Japan, and I had some absolutely fantastic musical experiences and also made some observations that I want to discuss. But before we get into everything that happened while I was overseas, two albums unexpectedly dropped in the final week of the year. So let's check them out. First up, Run the Jewels 3 came out and the world exploded in happiness. Simply put, there is no other hip-hop act on the planet right now that exists in the same stratosphere as RTJ. The team of LP and Killer Mike delivered the best record of 2014, and paired with their 2013 debut, the release of this third record was treading into very, very rare territory. That is to say, making one great record is certainly special, and not everyone can pull it off. Making two great records, not good records, great records, is pretty uncommon. I mean, think about it. Try and come up with bands that have a pair of unquestionably great albums in their catalog. Maybe about a dozen groups will come to mind real quick, but it starts to get a bit tricky after that. Now, after that, consider how many years of recorded music you're covering, and you can start to see how small a ratio it is for a group to have two great albums. It just doesn't happen that often. You want to make that ratio even smaller? Name me hip-hop artists that have two great records. There might be one or two at best, so the fact that Run the Jewels already have one for sure great album and one arguably great album has them in a class all their own. So the question becomes, could Run the Jewels 3 possibly be the unthinkable, a third great album? And if you ask most of the internet, they're going to scream yes whilst frothing at the mouth against anyone saying differently. But I'm going to argue that point, as this album is good at best and miles from great, though there are some impressive moments. First and foremost, this album isn't as fierce or as in-your-face as their previous release. Even at the top of the album, the moment when it's, you know, supposed to grab you and hook you, this record just doesn't. The track called Down is just that. It's kind of down. I mean, sure, it's smooth and it has a great beat, but it's really more of a mid-album track as opposed to the opener. The second track, which was also the first single, now that would have been a much better way to start things, but see, that's one of the issues here that becomes very quickly apparent. As we've come to expect from LP, his production skills are second to none, and he throws unconventional, innovative beats and sounds at every single turn. From the darker feel of Thursday in the Danger Room, to the smoothness of 2100, to the bass on Hey Kids, he puts on a masterclass as always. But maybe that's one of the problems here. We kind of know what to expect from a Run the Jewels project now, and it just doesn't have that surprise or wow factor anymore. This is sort of the expectation that we have here, and I think a lot of the hype around Run the Jewels 2 was because it was so different, and this album just isn't, at least for them. At the same time, this album also has filler. Scream and shout all you want, but the center of this record drags really bad. Stay Gold, Don't Get Captured, and Thieves are just boring musically, and only the last of those makes up for it with the lyrics. Along with those songs, there's a general feeling of malaise running throughout the majority of this record. It's not that they're lazy or don't care, but, well, there's just very little excitement to be had on this album. Like I said, though, there are some moments I really, really dug on the record. Here's a bit from 2100 where Killer Mike is absolutely on fire. Looking folk, life is beautiful, and we ain't got to die for the mother men. And I refuse to kill another human being in the name of a government. Cause I don't study war no more. I don't hate the poor no more. Getting more ain't what's more. Only thing more is the love. So when you see me, please greet me with a heart full and a pound and a hug. Other highlights for me are lines like, I'm the Nelson Mandela of Atlanta dope sellers, or most of the song Talk to Me. Here's a second from that. Great man didn't die face down in the Vietnam muscle, so I cannot style on you. I didn't walk uphill both ways to the booth and back and I'd wild on you. You think baby Jesus killed Hitler just so I'd whisper? And you're safe and sound and these crooks tap your phone and I have a file on you. I was also really enjoying the song Hey Kids until Danny Brown showed up for a verse. The guy has the most annoying flow in hip-hop and absolutely ruins everything he touches. Yeah, Zach De La Rocha from Rage Against the Machine makes another RTJ appearance near the end of the record, but if anything, it highlights how predictable the album is as a whole. I really think that Run the Jewels have sort of run their course. They've made many amazing songs and pushed the hip-hop genre miles forward. Now, maybe it's because this album is about 15 minutes longer than their two previous that makes it feel overdone and overstaying its welcome, but I just don't see many songs here that I'm going to go back to. That's it. That is what I'm trying to say. Run the Jewels 3 is the first album they've done that has filler, and it's far from solid from beginning to end. And when you're as talented as these two are, those cracks quickly show upon comparison. That's what I'm trying to get at. Now still, Killer Mike and LP are two of the best in hip-hop these days, so it might be worth giving it a listen just to hear it, but as far as I'm concerned, this is so far from their previous releases, and maybe it's time for LP to really work with other people, and maybe Mike can do a record with Zach. I don't know, but for me, this album's going to be a pass. The other record that was released before the year closed out? Well, the last we heard from Nine Inch Nails was technically 2014's Seed 8 EP, which was basically remixes of songs from 2013's Hesitation Marks, which was an album I thought was pretty weak. For my money, the last great moment from Nine Inch Nails was 2008's criminally underappreciated album The Slip, which at that point was Trent Reznor's finest work in about 15 years. But let's be honest. Whenever anything new comes out under the name Nine Inch Nails, it's more than deserving of attention. And when you're the man responsible for the absolutely perfect Broken EP from back in 92, the allure of a short-form album has me clawing for the release. Nine Inch Nails was technically on hiatus for the last year or so, but very late last year, Trent started to tease that he'd have new music out before January 1st. Lo and behold, December 22nd brought us an EP called Not the Actual Events, and there's quite a bit of sound packed into these 21 minutes. Let's start with the highlights, particularly the pairing of the songs She's Gone Away and The Idea of You. The volume here is overloaded, and it's just this massive wall of sound. The former, almost, I don't know, it feels like a snake slithering to me, and I really dig the reverb-y sounds in the background. Check it out. The Idea of You is sheer sonic chaos in the best way, and it serves as a reminder of just how well Trent Reznor understands when too much is, well, too much. These songs run right up to the line, but they never cross it. The EP closer, Burning Bright, is also super heavy and it kind of has this typo negative feel to it, but all three songs suffer from the same problem. They overstay their welcome. Trent digs into these soundscapes, but in a rare misstep from him, it just seems that he can't figure out when to fade out or just pull the plug on the song. Oddly enough, the very brief opening track is where the opposite occurs. All you want from Branches and Bones is more, and it feels very incomplete. Trent himself said that with this EP, he was, and I'm quoting here, more just feeling around in the dark and seeing what sounds interesting, and I actually think that might be the problem here. These songs feel like parts and pieces of a project in the works. They're more than demos, but they don't seem finished or a part of the same musical thought. Maybe they'll morph into other works down the road. I don't know. In the end, though, Not the Actual Events is well worth the 21 minutes just to hear what Trent's up to these days, and more than half of the EP is very satisfying. But if you were looking for a musical revelation or something on par with his previous EPs, this just isn't it. Moving on. Japan. First off, my real reason for going was it was my wife and my long postponed honeymoon, and we're not really the sit on the beach for a week types. So we planned a very aggressive 18 days, hitting 9 cities and taking in as much of that wonderful country as we could. Neither of us had ever been nor speak much Japanese, but adventure? Adventure we love. Now, I knew in advance that Japan, specifically Tokyo, is a vinyl collector's paradise, as there are tons of record shops, and I cannot tell you how many times I was digging through a record crate and I said out loud, "No way, this cannot exist." And yes, I made a number of purchases, and we're going to get to the actual record shopping in a bit. What I want to discuss today, though, is how different and fascinating I found the Japanese musical culture. As in all of my travels, I've never experienced anything like it. There were so many small touches and unique instances that really set it in a class all its own. On some levels, I actually think Japan may be the most musically inclined country I've been to because it really does show up in both big and small ways in unexpected yet delightful parts of everyday life. There's actually so much to talk about that I'm not quite sure where to start, so you know what? Let's start in an odd place. Trucks. That's right, trucks. Let's start with one of the most unique things I saw in terms of exposing people to new music, as it's a tactic I haven't seen in a very long time. We're talking a decade plus here. I believe we were just south of the Harajuku district, and this truck just kind of went by. It was a smaller box truck, but it had a narrow billboard of sorts on the back, and, you know, the billboard part isn't that odd, but it's the rest of the truck I want to talk about. It had a pretty big sound system on board, and it was playing a J-pop song very, very, very loud. And the billboard advertised that what was playing was a new single from some group I didn't know that was going to be released a few days later. Forget radio airplay, inline ads, whatever. This was taking music directly to your audience, as the truck was clearly driving a circular route around the area where all the teenagers were hanging out. It was pure genius as far as I was concerned. For the cost of a driver and a truck for the day, I'm guessing it was exponentially more effective in terms of reaching and engaging the target audience. Now, I am not saying that I wish for the day when the new Bon Jovi single is force blared into my ears as I'm walking down 6th Avenue because I'd kill someone, but this is a really smart tactic that I think the US industry can learn from. Things like radio, streaming music, all that, it's rather passive. And with the truck idea, you know, you can also get some visuals going, maybe some giveaways, who knows? Again, this isn't something to do every time there's a new single going out, but it could have some very, very cool results. Speaking of things you don't see in the States, I cannot tell you how big my smile was when I saw a completely legit Tower Records. In fact, I saw a number of them throughout the country. Big red on yellow sign, random music-related gifts, headphones, t-shirts, whole nine yards. It had been so long since I was in a Tower Records. But to be honest, it's actually the contents I found inside the store that may have been the most insightful and interesting thing I saw in all of Japan in terms of music. What did I see? CDs. Tons of CDs. Seriously. Wall-to-wall CDs, and this was a very large store. For those of you who live in the States, when was the last time you saw a CD store? Best Buy has like a dozen, maybe. And it's just hard to find a place that stocks CDs because I know what you're thinking. Who the hell buys CDs in 2017? Well, apparently the Japanese do, and they buy a lot of them. I asked a number of locals while I was there about why they'd buy CDs in an era of digital downloads and whatnot, and they gave me a variety of reasons, but what was clear was that CDs were very much preferred. But this goes well beyond just the existence of CD-based music in stores in this case, as the actual music they were selling was something I really hadn't seen before in many, many ways. Now, I'm not saying I'm Captain World Traveler, but I've been to my fair share of foreign countries over the years. And because I'm a huge music geek, wherever I go, I find at least a few music shops to check out. From amazing heavy metal selections in Sweden, to wildly avant jazz in France, to all sorts of rare stuff here and there. Music stores around the world always have their specialties, but they always have common threads. Wherever you go, chances are you can track down a band like, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, Nirvana, Queen, you know, the big bands that have had just massive worldwide impact. Also, there's usually some semblance of the current worldwide pop music scene. That's to say, you know, these days you're going to find Beyonce, Ariana Grande, Drake, you get the idea. But at all of the mainstream music stores I went to in Japan, it was nothing but Japanese music. Nothing. Japanese pop, Japanese rock, metal, rap, you name it. 100% Japanese and not even a small shelf with international artists. Sure, some of the CDs may have featured English or other language lyrics, but the artists themselves were all from Japan. The entire store. Every store. Yeah, the vinyl-focused shops I visited were different, but for the teenagers and pop fans, there's a very clear preference for the homemade sounds, and I think that's why J-pop music and K-pop music and things like that are as big as they are. Because within Japan, the way the songs are structured, how they sound, how they're presented, it just makes more sense there and it has that appeal. That's not to say that pop music can't transcend culture, but it's very obvious that that specific sound, as it applies to all forms of music, really goes ahead of anything else that's going to come in as an import. Now, we do see it on a slightly smaller scale with the difference between pop hits in the US and the UK, but there's a heavy crossover from both of those countries to the rest of the world when it comes to music. But really, when it came to Japan, pun intended, they seem to be on an island all their own. For those wondering, yes, I wrote down a ton of titles and I had a blast using their listening stations, and we're going to get to what I found in the future. Also, we need to bring back listening stations on a larger scale. You know, forget about the gross headphones. It is an awesome way to get into music you don't know, and really, I had so much fun at listening stations. I miss them. Shifting from the more mainstream record stores, it's no secret, like I said, Japan is a vinyl lover's paradise, and Tokyo is the hotbed of this action. Even a store like HMV, which are primarily pop outlets in other countries, even HMV sells loads of new and used vinyl in Japan, at least in the ones that I found. I visited, I don't know, maybe a dozen different record shops while I was there, and before I get to the selection I found, I have to mention the condition. Anyone who's ever dug through crates knows the heartbreak of finding that album you've been looking for forever, only to see scratches and dings all over it. Well, friends, not in Japan. The overall quality of the records there was outstanding. I have no idea where they keep the dinged and scratched records. They just must ship them overseas, but I didn't find them, which I did not mind. But I'll tell you, I also had a lot of trouble finding Japanese pressings of albums. I figured it'd be more than easy being in Japan and all, but the majority of what I found were, you know, US and UK pressings, which isn't terrible. But what you may not know is that many albums have different or additional tracks for Japanese pressings. It's been going on for decades, and I was really hoping to score some rarities like that. But alas, I had to settle for scoring other albums that I love. One place I want to specifically mention is called Vinyl Japan. It's somewhere in the Shinjuku district, I believe, and it's a bit difficult to find due to the lack of signage. However, upon entering, my jaw hit the ground because it was basically nothing but punk and hardcore vinyl. Old school, new school, ska, US, UK, Aussie, you name it, it was punk rock heaven. I mean, I damn near had tears in my eyes when I saw that they had an entire section just dedicated to the Ruts. It was that specific. Tons of 7-inches and bootlegs. It was actually kind of overwhelming, really. I ended up snagging a pair of gorgeous Ruts 7-inches while I was there, and while I take a quick breath of air, here's part of one of them, a little bit of West One Shine On Me. Lights in the night, burning red and white. Also, a shout out to Face Records, where I stumbled across an original pressing of Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style on vinyl. Oh, so happy to have that in the collection. And then there was a store called Manual of Errors in the Shibuya district, where I found what's basically two LPs of Japanese singers covering classic country songs. It's pretty damn amazing, as was finding the store. To find the shop, I went up to the 11th floor of an apartment building, and then I walked on the outside of the building around a corner, and there's this nondescript store that is the shop. The owner was totally cool. He had tons of stuff I'd never heard of, and if you're in Japan, hit up these stores, well worth the experience. Now, shifting away from the stores and music, I want to take a bit of time to discuss the music I encountered in kind of more of a cultural perspective, as the Japanese have a very unique relationship with music from what I observed. On many levels, it was nothing I'd ever experienced before, and I think a great place to start here is the idea of volume. Granted, I live in one of the loudest cities on the planet here in New York City, but most of my life was spent in smaller cities, so I know quiet when I hear it, or, you know, don't hear it. Anyway, Tokyo is a huge city. I was blown away by just how big it was, but it was so quiet when you compare the level of noise to the size and population. And this is not just on the surface, because I noticed it most in the subways. Here in New York and pretty much every other subway system I've spent time on, the vast majority of people have headphones in and they're preoccupied in one way or another. In the very worst case, you get those people whose headphones are cranked up so high you can hear them from across the car, or some moron that has a small boombox and you're going to hear those two words that every New Yorker loathes. It's showtime! This is the calling card of people who do rather annoying acrobatic dancing in crowded subway cars, and thankfully it's been on the decline for the last year or so, but I digress. Back to my point, the subways were amazingly quiet, and very few people had headphones in. This really goes against everything I've seen in big cities where people use that commute time to listen to music or watch a show or something, but that collective silence of sorts, I mean, you could literally whisper and be heard, was pretty amazing. But again, back to the music. See, in most cities around the world, the subway stops are denoted by a ding or a tone or an announcement of the stop that you're at. But in Japan, from local subways to the various trains that go city to city, music is very much a part of the process. On the subways, there's a bit of music before each announcement, and it's usually the same, while on the bullet trains and other cross-country trains, each stop gets its own song. Here's a few examples, and my apologies for the recording quality. All I had on me was my cell phone. Now, while most of the stops were just a nice little jingle, one stood out very quickly. I think we were somewhere between Tokyo and Iyama, and when the stop approached, the music that played was absolutely 100% undeniably Oh Susanna. Yeah, the Stephen Foster song from 1848, and here it was being played in the middle of the Japanese countryside. It was absolutely surreal, but sadly it didn't play again, so I couldn't capture it. At the same time, though, the fact that there's such a powerful presence of music was refreshing. It made the stops a bit brighter, I suppose, and it was far better than just a ding-dong and an unintelligible announcement. Speaking of ding-dong, and no, not the hostess snack, at almost every hotel we stayed at, they had rather lengthy musical doorbells for the rooms. I don't know, I just wanted to mention it because it was unexpected and it put a smile on my face every single time. The last thing I want to mention is the way that the Japanese seem to deal with cover songs. Now, we all know classic covers. Hendrix doing All Along the Watchtower, The Clash doing I Fought the Law, Johnny Cash covering Hurt, and it's not always a bad thing to hear a random cover from time to time. But if we're being honest, there are a lot of songs out there that just don't need to be covered. Either they're so perfect that nobody should touch them, or they were bad or unique enough that they're better left to be forgotten. Jamiroquai's Virtual Insanity certainly falls into the latter of those categories, and yet it was one of many strange covers I heard during my time in Japan. All of these covers, like a very similar sounding version of Whitney Houston's Impossible to Avoid I Will Always Love You, were stripped down to this slow, soft piano and a whispery female vocalist. Now, I love me a great female vocal, and if you give it some dark, dusky mood, I'm going to play it all the time. But these fell more on the side of cheesy Holiday Inn lounge singer rejects, and many of them made me giggle. Add to the fact that these songs were trying to like set the mood at classy restaurants in a few occasions, and I was more than entertained, but I doubt that was their goal. If anyone can give me more insight into the musical choices in this case, I'd really love some history behind them for sure, but in the end, if you're into music, I cannot recommend highly enough a trip to Japan. Hit me up on Twitter at GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru and let me know your favorite unique musical things that you found in other countries. Now, before we wrap the episode, I do, of course, have your weekly EarFuel listening assignment. For those of you new to the podcast, each week I assign an album to listen to in full, beginning to end, without any distractions or interruptions. It stems from the fact that these days, music has become largely relegated to a background task. You're at work, you're driving, you're at the gym, whatever. And this assignment is about taking some time each week to consciously listen to music for the sake of music alone. This week, since I picked up some of their music in Japan, and I mentioned them back in October as a band you need to know, your musical assignment is the first album from The Ruts, 1979's The Crack. You see, my voice gets excited even just saying the name of this band. I love them so much. And while The Ruts are most certainly punk rock, on many levels, they stand in strong opposition to the notions of what most people perceive as punk rock. That is to say, they were incredibly talented musicians, and their songs had a very solid structure to them that went well beyond the confines of the simple two-minute song. The Ruts were about feel and attitude in terms of punk rock, and their sound and style are in a league all their own. Guitarist Paul Fox smashes the punk stereotype as he deploys killer riffs, but absolutely outstanding solos at the same time, and soloing just didn't happen in punk rock until this point. And certainly if it was not to this level of quality. His tone is outrageously good, and he just had this ability to put the exact right touches on a song. Here, you know what? Check out some of Something That I Said. Combine his playing with the tightness of the rhythm section, and musically, few bands can even hold a candle to The Ruts. But see, here's the thing. These songs have a pop sensibility and a feel to it you can't ignore. They're very appealing and catchy, and this is sort of where you can see the crossover from punk into the mainstream. Or, I don't know, at least you would have seen it had the band not ended as quickly as they did, but you can't deny that the blueprint for that movement is right here in The Ruts. Malcolm Owen's voice is the ideal sound up front for this band, as he's got the gritty sound that complements the clean, crisp musical arrangements, and there's an intensity in his voice that grabs you every time and injects you with the energy and just, you know, the get up and go that you need. You cannot escape the power of his voice, and it vaults these songs to greatness every time. Really, from the get-go, this is a full-on, no-holds-barred musical assault, and each song picks you up, kicks your ass, and gets you ready to fight again. Here is the very opening of the record. I mean, really, you can't not get into these songs. The music gets into your veins so quickly, and you're going to find yourself rocking out on the first spin. These are anthems of the people, and even almost four decades later, they haven't lost a bit of their impact. Whether it's the frantic pace of You're Just A, the anti-police abuse rally cry of Sus, or the deep grinding groove of Backbiter, every second of The Crack is sheer perfection, and these are the sort of songs that you play louder and louder every single time, and honestly, this is one of those records that's rarely out of my arm's reach. Flying solos, fist-pumping lyrics, addictively perfect riffs, deep grooves, all wrapped up with a punk middle finger that has an appeal across every musical style. There's just no other band in history that compares to The Ruts, and they top my list of underappreciated bands. I mean, seriously, I could do an entire episode just on how fantastic The Ruts are, and maybe sometime down the line I will. But for now, if you don't know The Crack, you really need to add it to your collection right now. Thank me later. So that's all for this week. You can hit me up on Twitter at GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru. And as always, the podcast is available in the iTunes and Google Play stores, along with at GetEarFuel.com. That is your weekly EarFuel. Share and enjoy.